shape of Brianna's kiln lying some way from the cabin, unused since her departure, and a spurt of excitement drew him upright. That would be... But no. Arch had stolen the gold from Jocasta Cameron one bar at a time, conveying it secretly to the ridge, and had begun his theft long before Brianna had gone. But maybe... Ian stiffened suddenly, and Jamie turned his head sharp to see what the matter was. He couldn't see anything, but then caught the sound that Ian had heard. A deep, piggish grunt, a rustle, a crack. Then there was a visible stirring among the blackened timbers of the ruined house, and a great light dawned. Jesus, he said, and gripped Ian's arm so tightly that his nephew yelped, startled. It's under the big house. The white sow emerged from her den beneath the ruins, a massive cream-coloured blotch upon the night, and stood swaying her head to and fro, scenting the air. Then she began to move, a ponderous menace surging purposefully up the hill. Jamie wanted to laugh at the sheer beauty of it. Archbug had cannily hidden his gold beneath the foundations of the big house, choosing his times when the sow was out about her business. No one would have dreamed of invading the sow's domain. She was the perfect guardian, and doubtless he'd meant to retrieve the gold in the same way when he was ready to go, carefully, one ingot at a time. But then the house had burned, the timbers collapsing into the foundation, rendering the gold unreachable without a great deal of work and trouble, which would certainly draw attention. It was only now, when the men had cleared away most of the rubble and spread soot and charcoal all over the clearing in the process, that anyone might be able to reach something hidden under it without attracting notice. But it was winter, and the white sow, while not hibernating like a bear, kept strictly to her cozy den, save when there was something to eat. Ian made a small exclamation of disgust, hearing slobbering and crunching from the path.
"Pigs haven't got much delicacy of feeling," Jamie murmured. "If it's dead, they'll eat it."
"Aye, but it's likely her own offspring."
"She eats her young alive now and then. I doubt she'd boggle at eating them dead."
"Hest!"
He hushed at once, eyes fixed on the blackened smear that had once been the finest house in the county. Sure enough, a dark figure emerged from behind the spring house, sidling cautiously on the slippery path. The pig, busy with her grisly feast, ignored the man, who seemed to be clad in a dark cloak and carrying something like a sack. I didn't bolt the door at once, but stepped out to breathe fresh air for a moment, shutting Rollo in behind me. Within moments, Jamie and Ian had vanished into the trees. I glanced uneasily round the clearing, looking across to the black mass of the forest, but could see nothing amiss. Nothing moved, and the night was soundless. I wondered what Ian might have found. Unfamiliar track, perhaps? That would account for his sense of urgency. It was clearly about to snow. No moon was visible, but the sky was a deep pinkish grey, and the ground, though trodden and patchy, was still covered with old snow. The result was a strange milky glow in which objects seemed to float as though painted on glass, dimensionless and dim. The burnt remains of the big house stood at the far side of the clearing, no more at this distance than a smudge, as though a giant sooty thumb had pressed down there. I could feel the heaviness of impending snow in the air, hear it in the muffled sough of the pines. The MacLeod boys had come over the mountain with their grandmother. They'd said it was very hard going through the high passes. Another big storm would likely seal us in until March or even April. Thus reminded of my patient, I took one last look round the clearing and set my hand on the latch. Rollo was whining, scratching at the door, and I pushed a knee unceremoniously into his face as I opened it. "Stay, dog," I said. "Don't worry, they'll be back soon." He made a high, anxious noise in his throat and cast to and fro, nudging at my legs, seeking to get out.
"No," I said, pushing him away in order to bolt the door.
The bolt dropped into place with a reassuring thunk, and I turned toward the fire, rubbing my hands. Rollo put back his head and gave a low, mournful howl that raised the hair on the back of my neck.
"What?" I said, alarmed.
"Hush!" The noise had made one of the small children in the bedroom wake and cry. I heard rustling bedclothes and sleepy maternal murmurs, and I knelt quickly and grabbed Rollo's muzzle before he could howl again.
"Shh!" I said,
and looked to see whether the sound had disturbed Granny MacLeod. She lay still, waxen-faced, her eyes closed. I waited, automatically counting the seconds before the next shallow rise of her chest. 6. 7.
"Oh, bloody hell," I said, realizing.
Hastily crossing myself, I shuffled over to her on my knees, but closer inspection told me nothing I hadn't seen already. Self-effacing to the last, she had seized my moment of distraction to die inconspicuously.
Rollo was shifting to and fro, no longer howling but uneasy.
I laid a hand gently on the sunken chest, not seeking diagnosis or offering aid, not any longer. Just a necessary acknowledgement of the passing of a woman whose first name I didn't know.
"Well, God rest your soul, poor thing," I said softly,
and sat back on my heels, trying to think what to do next. Proper Highland protocol held that the door must be opened at once after a death to allow the soul to leave. I rubbed a knuckle dubiously over my lips. Might the soul have made a quick dash when I opened the door to come in? Probably not. One would think that in a climate as inhospitable as Scotland's, there would be a bit of climatological leeway in such matters. But I knew that wasn't the case. Rain, snow, sleet, wind, Highlanders always did open the door and leave it open for hours, both eager to free the departing soul and anxious lest the spirit, impeded in its exit, might turn and take up permanent residence as a ghost. Most crofts were too small to make that a tolerable prospect. Little Orrie was awake now. I could hear him singing happily to himself, a song consisting of his stepfather's name.
Babby, Babby, Babby.
I heard a low, sleepy chuckle and Bobby's murmur in reply.
"There's my wee man. You need the pot, Acushla?"
The Gaelic endearment, Acushla, my heart's blood, made me smile, both at the word and at the oddness of it in Bobby's Dorset accent. Rollo made an uneasy noise in his throat, though, bringing back to me the need for some action. If the Higginses and in-laws rose in a few hours to discover a corpse on the floor, they'd all be disturbed, their sense of rightness affronted, and agitated at the thought of a dead stranger possibly clinging to their hearth. A very bad omen for the new marriage and the new year. At the same time, her presence was undeniably agitating Rollo, and the prospect of his rousing them all in the next few moments was agitating me.
"Right," I said, under my breath. "Come on, dog."
There were, as always, bits of harness needing mending on a peg near the door. I disentangled a sound length of rein and fashioned a makeshift come-along with which I lassoed Rollo. He was more than happy to go outside with me, lunging ahead as I opened the door, though somewhat less delighted to be dragged to the lean-to pantry, where I wrapped the makeshift leash hastily round a shelf upright before returning to the cabin for Granny MacLeod's body. I looked about carefully before venturing out again, Jamie's admonitions in mind. But the night was still as a church. Even the trees had fallen silent. The poor woman couldn't weigh more than 70 pounds, I thought. Her collarbones poked through her skin, and her fingers were frail as dried twigs. Still, £70 of literal dead weight was a bit more than I could manage to lift, and I was obliged to unfold the blanket wrapped round her and use it as an impromptu sledge, on which I dragged her outside, murmuring mingled prayers and apologies under my breath. Despite the cold, I was panting and damp with sweat by the time I'd got her into the pantry.
"Well, at least your soul's had plenty of time to make a getaway," I muttered, kneeling to check the body before resettling it in its hasty shroud.
"And I shouldn't imagine you want to hang about haunting a pantry in any case." Her eyes were not quite closed, a sliver of white showing, as though she had tried to open them for one last glimpse of the world, or perhaps in search of a familiar face.
"Benedicite," I whispered,
and gently shut her eyes, wondering as I did so whether one day some stranger might do the same for me. The odds of it were good, unless...
Jamie had declared his intention to return to Scotland, fetch his printing press, and then come back to fight.
"But what?" said a small, cowardly voice inside me. "If we didn't come back? What if we went to Lallybroch and stayed there?"
Even as I thought of that prospect, with its rosy visions of being enfolded by family, able to live in peace, to grow slowly old without the constant fear of disruption, starvation and violence, I knew it wouldn't work. I didn't know whether Thomas Wolfe had been right about not being able to go home again. Well, I wouldn't know about that, I thought, a little bitterly. I hadn't had one to go back to.
But I did know Jamie. Idealism quite aside, and he did have some, though of a very pragmatic sort, the simple fact was that he was a proper man, and thus required to have proper work. Not just labour, not just making a living. Work. I understood the difference. And while I was sure that Jamie's family would receive him with joy, the nature of my own reception was in somewhat more doubt. But I supposed they wouldn't actually call the priest and try to have me exorcised. The fact was that Jamie was no longer Laird of Lallybroch, and never would be. "And his place shall know him no more," I murmured, wiping the old woman's intimate parts, surprisingly unwithered. Perhaps she'd been younger than I thought, with a damp cloth. She hadn't eaten anything in days. Even the relaxation of death hadn't had much effect. But anyone deserved to go clean to their grave. I paused. That was a thought. Would we be able to bury her? Or might she just rest peacefully under the huckleberry jam and the sacks of dried beans until spring? I tidied her clothes, breathing out, open-mouthed, trying to judge the temperature from the steam of my breath. This would be only the second major snowfall of the winter, and we had not yet had a really hard freeze. That usually happened in mid to late January. If the ground had not yet frozen, we could probably bury her, provided the men were willing to shovel away the snow. Rollo had lain down, resigned, while I went about my business, but at this point his head jerked upright, ears pointed. "What?" I said, startled, and turned round on my knees to look out the open pantry door. "What's happening?"
"Shall we take him now?"
Ian murmured. He had his bow over one shoulder. He let his arm fall, and the bow dropped silently into his hand, ready.
"No, let him find it first."
Jamie spoke slowly, trying to make up his mind what was right to do with the man so suddenly reappeared before him.
"Not kill him. He and his wife had made a good deal of trouble with their treachery, aye, but hadn't intended harm to his family. Not to start, at least. Was Archbug even truly a thief, by his own lights? Surely Jamie's Aunt Jocasta had no greater, if no lesser, claim to the gold than he did."
He sighed and put a hand to his belt where his dirk and pistol hung. Still, he couldn't allow Bug to make off with the gold, nor could he merely drive him off and leave him free to make more trouble. And to what in God's name to do with him once caught? It will be like having a snake in a sack. But naught to do now, save catch him, and worry later what to do with the sack. Perhaps some bargain might be struck. The figure had reached the black smear of the foundations and was climbing awkwardly among the stones and the charred timbers that remained, the dark cloak lifting and billowing as the air shifted. Snow began to fall, sudden and silent, big, lazy flakes that seemed not so much to fall from the sky as simply to appear, whirling out of the air. They brushed his face and stuck thick in his lashes. He wiped them away and motioned to Ian.
"Go behind," he whispered. "If he runs, send a shaft past his nose to stop him. And keep well back, eh?" "You keep well back, uncle," Ian whispered back. "If you get within decent pistol shot of the man, he can bring you with his axe. And I'm not going to explain that to Auntie Claire."
Jamie snorted briefly and nudged Ian away. He loaded and primed his pistol, then walked firmly out through the falling snow toward the ruin of his house. He'd seen Arch fell a turkey with his axe at 20 feet, and it was true that most pistols weren't accurate at much more than that. But he didn't mean to shoot the man, after all. He drew the pistol, holding it clear in his hand.
"Arch!" he called.
The figure had its back to him, bent over as it rooted about in the ashes. At his call it seemed to stiffen, still crouched.
"Arch Bug!" he shouted. "Come out of there, man! I'd speak with ye!"
In answer, the figure drew itself up abruptly, turned, and a spurt of flame lit the falling snow. In the same instant, the flame seared his thigh, and he staggered. He was conscious mostly of surprise. He'd never known Archbug to use a pistol, and was impressed that he could aim so well with his left. He'd gone to one knee in the snow, but even as he brought his own weapon up to bear, he realized two things. The black figure was aiming a second pistol at him, but not with the left hand, which meant,
"Jesus, Ian!"
But Ian had seen him fall and seen the second pistol too. Jamie didn't hear the arrow's flight above the rush of wind and snow. It appeared, as though by magic, stuck in the figure's back. The figure went straight and stiff, then fell in a heap. Almost before it hit the ground, he was running, hobbling, his right leg buckling under him with every step.
"God, no, God, no," he was saying,
and it sounded like someone else's voice. A voice came through the snow and night, calling out in desperation. Then Rollo was bounding past him, a blur. Who'd let him out? And a rifle cracked from the trees. Ian bellowed, somewhere near, calling the dog. But Jamie had no time to look, was scrambling heedless over the blackened stones, slipping on the skim of fresh snow, stumbling. His leg was cold and hot at once, but no matter. "Oh, God, please, no!" He reached the black figure and flung himself on his knees beside it, grappling. He knew at once. He'd known from the moment he realized the pistol had been held in her right hand. Arch, with his missing fingers, couldn't fire a pistol right-handed.
But, oh, God, no.
He'd got her over, feeling the short, heavy body limp and unwieldy as a fresh-killed deer, pushed back the hood of the cloak, and passed his hand, gentle, helpless, over the soft, round face of Merdina Bug. She breathed against his hand, perhaps. But he felt the shaft of the arrow, too, against his hand. It had come through her neck, and her breath bubbled wet. His hand was wet, too, and warm.
"Arch," she said hoarsely. "I want Arch."
And died. Chapter 3. Life for Life. I took Jamie into the pantry. It was dark and cold, particularly for a man with no breeches on, but I didn't want to risk any of the Higginses being wakened. God, not now. They'd all erupt from their sanctum like a flight of panicked quail. and I quailed myself at the thought of having to deal with them before I had to. It would be sufficiently horrible to tell them what had happened by daylight. I couldn't face the prospect now. For lack of any better alternative, Jamie and Ian had laid Mrs. Bug in the pantry alongside Granny MacLeod, tucked under the lowest shelf, her cloak drawn up over her face. I could see her feet sticking out, with their cracked, worn boots and striped stockings. I had a sudden vision of the Wicked Witch of the West, and clapped a hand to my mouth before anything truly hysterical could escape. Jamie turned his head toward me, but his gaze was inward, his face haggard, deep-lined in the glow of the candle he carried.
"Eh?"
he said vaguely. "Nothing," I said, my voice trembling. "Nothing at all. Sit down." I put down the stool and my medical kit, took the candle and tin of hot water from him, and tried to think of absolutely nothing but the job before me. Not feet. Not, for God's sake, Archbug. Jamie had a blanket wrapped round his shoulders, but his legs were necessarily bare, and I could feel the hairs bristling with goose flesh as my hand brushed them. The bottom of his shirt was soaked with half-dried blood. It stuck to his leg, but he made no sound when I pulled it loose and nudged his legs apart. He had been moving like a man in a bad dream, but the approach of a lighted candle to his balls roused him.
"You'll take care with that candle, Sassenach, aye?"
he said, putting a protective hand over his genitals. Seeing his point, I gave him the candle to hold, and with a brief admonition to beware of dripping hot wax, returned to my inspection. The wound was oozing blood, but plainly minor, and I plunged a cloth into the hot water and began to work. His flesh was chilled, and the cold damped even the pungent odours of the pantry, but I could still smell him, his usual dry musk tainted with blood and frantic sweat. It was a deep gouge that ran 4 inches through the flesh of his thigh, high up. Clean, though. "A John Wayne special," I said, trying for a light, dry tone. Jamie's eyes, which had been fixed on the candle flame, changed focus and fixed on me.
"What?"
he said hoarsely. "Nothing serious," I said. "The ball just grazed you. You may walk a little oddly for a day or two, but the hero lives to fight another day." The ball had, in fact, gone between his legs, deeply creasing the inside of his thigh, near both to his testicles and his femoral artery. 1 inch to the right, and he'd be dead. 1 inch higher.
"Not a great help, Sassenach," he said.
But the ghost of a smile touched his eyes.
"No," I agreed.
"Some?"
"Some," he said,
and briefly touched my face. His hand was very cold and trembled. Hot wax ran over the knuckles of his other hand, but he didn't seem to feel it. I took the candlestick gently from him and set it on the shelf. I could feel the grief and self-reproach coming off him in waves and fought to keep it at bay. I couldn't help him if I gave in to the enormity of the situation. I wasn't sure I could help him in any case, but I'd try.
"Oh, Jesus," he said,
so softly I barely heard him.
"Why did I not let him take it? What did it matter?"
He struck a fist on his knee, soundless.
"God, why did I not just let him take it?"
"You didn't know who it was, or what they meant to do," I said, just as softly, putting a hand on his shoulder. "It was an accident." His muscles were bunched, hard with anguish. I felt it too, a hard knot of protest and denial. "No, it can't be true, it can't have happened," in my throat. But there was work to be done. I'd deal with the inescapable later. He put a hand over his face, shaking his head slowly to and fro, and neither spoke nor moved while I finished the cleaning and bandaging of the wound.
"Can you do aught for Ian?"
he said when I'd finished. He took his hand away and looked up at me as I stood, his face drawn in exhausted misery, but calm again. He swallowed and glanced at the door.
He's badly, Sassenach.
I glanced at the whiskey I'd brought, a quarter of a bottle. Jamie followed the direction of my gaze and shook his head.
Not enough.
You drink it, then. He shook his head, but I put the bottle in his hand and pressed his fingers round it.
Orders, I said, soft but very firm. Shock.
He resisted, made to put the bottle back, and I tightened my hand on his.
I know, I said. Jamie, I know. But you can't give in. Not now.
He looked down at me for a moment, but then he nodded, accepting it because he had to, the muscles of his arm relaxing. My own fingers were stiff, chilled from water and frigid air, but still warmer than his. I folded both hands round his free one and held it hard. There's a reason why the hero never dies, you know, I said, and attempted a smile, though my face felt stiff and false. When the worst happens, someone still has to decide what to do. Go into the house now and get warm. I glanced out at the night, lavender-skied and wild with swirling snow. I'll find Ian.
Where could he have gone? Not far in this weather.
Given his state of mind when he and Jamie had come back with Mrs. Bug's body, he might, I thought, simply have walked off into the woods, not caring where he went or what happened to him. But he'd had the dog with him. No matter what he felt like, he wouldn't take Rollo off into a howling blizzard. And a blizzard was what it was shaping up to be. I made my way slowly uphill toward the outbuildings, sheltering my lantern under a fold of my cloak. It came to me suddenly to wonder whether Arch Bug might have taken shelter in the spring house or the smoke shed, and, oh God, did he know? I stopped dead on the path for an instant, letting the thickly falling snow settle like a veil on my head and shoulders. I had been so shocked by what had happened that I hadn't thought to wonder whether Archbug knew that his wife was dead. Jamie said that he had called out, called for Arch to come as soon as he realized, but there had been no answer. Perhaps Arch had suspected a trick. Perhaps he had simply fled, seeing Jamie and Ian and assuming they would certainly not harm his wife. In which case... Oh, bloody hell, I said under my breath, appalled. But there was nothing I could do about that. I hoped there was something I could do about Ian. I rubbed a forearm over my face, blinked snow from my lashes, and went on slowly, the light from the lanterns swallowed in the vortex of whirling snow. Were I to find Arch? My fingers clenched on the lantern's handle. I'd have to tell him. Bring him back to the cabin. Let him see... Oh, dear. If I came back with Arch, could Jamie and Ian occupy him long enough for me to remove Mrs. Bug from the pantry and display her in a more seemly fashion? I hadn't had time to remove the jutting arrow or lay out the body decently. I dug the fingernails of my free hand into the palm, trying to get a grip of myself. Jesus, don't let me find him. I said under my breath, please don't let me find him. But springhouse, smoke shed, and corn crib were all, thank God, empty. And no one could have hidden in the chicken coop without the chickens making a fuss about it. They were silent, sleeping out the storm. The sight of the coop brought Mrs. Bug suddenly to mind, though. The vision of her scattering corn from her apron, crooning to the silly things. She'd named them all. I didn't bloody care whether we were eating Ishabel or Alistair for supper. But just at the moment, the fact that no one now would ever be able to tell one from another, or rejoice in the fact that Elspeth had hatched 10 chicks, seemed unspeakably heartrending.
I found Ian at last in the barn, a dark form huddled in the straw by the feet of Clarence the mule, whose ears pricked up at my appearance. He brayed ecstatically at the prospect of more company, and the goats blatted hysterically, thinking I was a wolf. The horses, surprised, tossed their heads, snorting and nickering in question. Rollo, nestled in the hay next to his master, gave a short, sharp bark of displeasure at the racket. "Ruddy Noah's Ark in here," I remarked, shaking snow off my cloak and hanging the lantern on a hook. "All we need is a pair of elephants. Hush, Clarence." Ian turned his face toward me, but I could see from his blank expression that he hadn't taken in what I'd said. I squatted next to him and cupped a hand round his cheek. It was cold, bristled with young beard.
"It wasn't your fault," I said gently. "I know," he said, and swallowed. "But I dinna see how I can live."
He wasn't dramatic about it at all. His voice was simply bewildered. Rollo licked his hand, and his fingers sank into the dog's ruff as though for support.
"What can I do, Auntie?"
He looked at me, helpless.
"There's nothing, is there? I cannot take it back again or undo it. And yet I keep looking for some way that I can. Something I can do to make things right. But there's nothing."
I sat down in the hay next to him and put an arm round his shoulder, pressing his head toward me. He came, reluctantly, though I felt small, constant shudders of exhaustion and grief running through him like a chill.
"I loved her," he said,
so low I could barely hear him.
"She was like my grandmother, and I..."
"She loved you," I whispered. "She wouldn't blame you." I had been holding on to my own emotions like grim death in order to do what had to be done. But now, Ian was right. There was nothing. And in sheer helplessness, tears began to roll down my face. I wasn't crying. Grief and shock simply overflowed. I could not contain them. Whether he felt the tears on his skin, or only the vibrations of my grief, I couldn't tell. But quite suddenly, Ian gave way as well, and he wept in my arms, shaking. I wished with all my heart that he was a small boy, and that the storm of grief could wash away his guilt and leave him cleansed, at peace. But he was far beyond such simple things. All I could do was hold him and stroke his back, making small, helpless noises myself. Then Clarence offered his own support, breathing heavily on Ian's head and nibbling thoughtfully on a lock of his hair. Ian jerked away, slapping at the mule's nose.
"Ugh, away with you."
He choked, laughed in a shocked way, wept a little more, then straightened up and wiped his nose on his sleeve. He sat still for a little while, gathering the pieces of himself, and I let him be.
"When I killed that man in Edinburgh," he said at last, his voice thick but controlled, "Uncle Jamie took me to confession and told me the prayer that you say when you've killed someone, to commend them to God. Will you say it with me, Auntie?"
I hadn't thought of, let alone said, soul leading in many years, and stumbled awkwardly through the words. Ian spoke it without hesitation, though, and I wondered how often he had used it through those years. The words seemed puny and powerless, swallowed among the sounds of hay rustling and beasts chewing, but I felt a tiny bit of comfort for having said them. Perhaps it was only that the sense of reaching out to something larger than yourself gives you some feeling that there is something larger. And there really has to be, because plainly you aren't sufficient to the situation. I surely wasn't. Ian sat for a time, eyes closed. Finally, he opened them and looked at me, his eyes black with knowledge, face very pale under the stubble of his beard.
And then, he said, you live with it, he said softly.
He rubbed a hand across his face.
But I dinna think I can.
It was a simple statement of fact and scared me badly. I had no more tears, but felt as though I looked into a black bottomless hole and couldn't look away. I drew a deep breath, trying to think of something to say, then pulled a handkerchief from my pocket and gave it to him. Are you breathing, Ian? His mouth twitched a little.
I think so.
That's all you have to do, for now. I got up, brushed hay from my skirts, and held out a hand to him. Come along. We need to go back to the cabin before we're snowed in here. The snow was thicker now, and a gust of wind put out the candle in my lantern. It didn't matter. I could have found the cabin blindfolded. Ian went ahead of me without comment, breaking a trail through the fresh fallen snow. His head was bent against the storm, his narrow shoulders hunched. I hoped the prayer had helped him, at least a little, and wondered whether the Mohawk had any better means of dealing with unjust death than did the Catholic Church. Then I realized that I knew exactly what the Mohawk would do in such a case. So did Ian. He'd done it. I pulled the cloak tighter round me, feeling as though I had swallowed a large ball of ice. Chapter 4. Not Yet a While. After a good deal of discussion, the two corpses were carried gently outside and laid at the edge of the porch. There was simply no room to lay them out properly inside, and given the circumstances...
We canna let old Arch be in doubt any longer than he must, Jamie had said, putting an end to the arguments. If the body's in plain sight, maybe he'll come out, and maybe he'll not. But he'll ken his wife's dead.
He will, Bobby Higgins said, with an uneasy look toward the trees. And what do you think he'll do then?
Jamie stood for a moment, looking toward the wood, then shook his head.
Grieve, he said quietly. And in the morning, we'll see what's to do.
It wasn't the normal sort of wake, but it was conducted with what ceremony we could manage. Amy had donated her own shroud, made after her first wedding, and carefully kept by, for Mrs. Bug. And Granny MacLeod was clad in the remnants of my spare chemise and a couple of aprons hastily stitched up into respectability. They were laid one on either side of the porch, foot to foot, with a small saucer of salt and a slice of bread on the chest of each corpse, though no sin-eater was available. I had packed a small clay firepot with coals and set this near the bodies, and it was agreed that we would all take it in turns through the night to sit over the deceased, as the porch would hold no more than two or three people. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, I said softly. It did. The storm had blown over, and the three-quarter moon cast a pure, cold light that made each snow-covered tree stand out stark and delicate as a painting in Japanese ink. And in the distant ruins of the big house, the jackstraw of charred timbers hid whatever lay below. Jamie and I were taking the first watch. No one had argued when Jamie announced this. No one spoke of it, but the image of Arch Bug lurking alone in the forest was in everyone's mind.
You think he's there? I asked Jamie, low-voiced.
I nodded toward the dark trees, peaceful in their own soft shrouds.
If it were you lying here, Anian, Jamie said, looking down at the still white figures at the edge of the porch. I should be beside you, alive or dead. Come, sit down.
I sat down beside him, the firepot close to our cloak-wrapped knees.
Poor things, I said after a bit. It's a long way from Scotland.
It is,
he said, and took my hand. His fingers were no warmer than my own, but the size and strength of them were a comfort nonetheless.
But they'll be buried amongst folk who ken their ways, if not among their own kin.
True. Should Granny MacLeod's grandsons ever come back, at least they would find a marker for her grave, and know she had been treated with kindness. Mrs. Bug hadn't any kin, save Arch. No one to come and look for the grave marker. But she would be among people who'd known and loved her. What about Arch, though? If he had kin in Scotland, he'd never mentioned it. His wife had been everything to him, as he to her.
You don't think that Arch might do away with himself? I asked delicately. Once he knows.
Jamie shook his head, definite.
No, he said. It's not in him.
On one level, I was relieved to hear this. On a lower and less compassionate level, I couldn't help wondering uneasily just what a man of Arch's passions might do, stricken by this mortal blow, now bereft of the woman who had been his anchor and safe harbour for most of his life. What would such a man do, I wondered? Run before the wind until he hit a reef and sank? Or tie his life to the makeshift anchor of fury and take revenge as his new compass? I'd seen the guilt Jamie and Ian were bearing. How much more was Arch carrying? Could any man bear such guilt? Or must he turn it outward as a matter of simple survival? Jamie had said nothing about his own speculations, but I'd noticed that he had both pistol and dirk in his belt, and the pistol was loaded and primed. I could smell the whiff of black powder under the resinous breath of spruce and fir. Of course, it might be for driving off a roving wolf or foxes. We sat in silence for a little, watching the shifting glow of coals in the firepot and the flicker of light in the folds of the shrouds.
Ought we to pray, do you think? I whispered.
I haven't given over praying since it happened, Sassana.
I know what you mean. I did. The passionate prayer that it might not be, and the desperate prayer for guidance thereafter, the need to do something when nothing really could be done. And of course, prayer for the repose of the recently departed. At least Granny MacLeod had expected death, and welcomed it, I thought. Mrs. Bug, on the other hand, must have been terribly startled at being so suddenly dead. I had a disconcerting vision of her standing in the snow just off the porch, glaring at her corpse, hands on stout hips, lips pursed in annoyance at having been so rudely disembodied.
It was rather a shock, I said apologetically to her shade. Aye, it was that.
Jamie reached into his cloak and drew out his flask. Uncorking this, he leaned forward and carefully poured a few drops of whiskey on the head of each of the dead women, then lifted the flask in silent toast to Granny MacLeod, then to Mrs. Bug.
Mardina, wife of Archibald, were a great cook, he said simply. I'll recall your biscuits all my life, and think of you with my morning porridge.
Amen, I said, my voice trembling between laughter and tears. I accepted the flask and took a sip. The whiskey burned through the thickness in my throat, and I coughed.
I know her receipt for Piccalilli. That shouldn't be lost. I'll write it down.
The thought of writing reminded me quite suddenly of the unfinished letter still folded up in my work bag. Jamie felt the slight stiffening of my posture and turned his head toward me in question.
I was only thinking of that letter, I said, clearing my throat. I mean, in spite of Roger and Bree knowing the house has burnt down, they'll be happy to hear that we're still alive, always supposing they do eventually get it.
Aware both of the precarious times and of the uncertain survival of historical documents, Jamie and Roger had worked out several schemes for the passage of information, ranging from the publication of coded messages in various newspapers to something elaborate involving the Church of Scotland and the Bank of England. All of these, of course, relied upon the basic fact of the Mackenzie family having made the passage through the stones safely and arrived in, more or less, the right time. But I was obliged for my own peace of mind to assume that they had. But I don't want to end it by having to tell them about this. I nodded toward the shrouded figures. They loved Mrs. Bug, and Bree would be so upset for Ian.
Aye, you're right, Jamie said thoughtfully. And chances are that Roger Mack would think it all through and realize about Arch, knowing and not able to do anything about it. Aye, they'd be worried till they found another letter telling them how it's all come out. And God knows how long it may be before it has all come out.
And if they didn't get the next letter, or if we didn't survive long enough to write it, I thought.
Aye, best not tell them. Not yet a while.
I moved closer, leaning against him, and he put his arm around me. We sat quiet for a bit, still troubled and sorrowful, but comforted at the thought of Roger, Bree, and the children. I could hear sounds from the cabin behind me. Everyone had been quiet, shocked, but normality was fast reasserting itself. Children couldn't be kept quiet long, and I could hear high-pitched questions, demands for food, the chatter of little ones excited at being up so late, their voices threading through the clanging and thumps of food preparation. There would be bannocks and pasties for the next part of the wake. Mrs. Bug would be pleased. A sudden shower of sparks flew from the chimney and fell all round the porch like falling stars, brilliant against the dark night and the white, fresh snow. Jamie's arm tightened round me, and he made a small sound of pleasure at the sight.
That... what you said about the briefs to the new fallen snow, that's a poem, is it?
It is. Not really appropriate to awake. It's a comic Christmas poem called A Visit from St. Nicholas. Jamie snorted, his breath white.
I dinna think the word appropriate has much to do with a proper wake, Sassenach. Give the mourners enough drink, and they'll be singing O Hoya Anal Im Botul, and the wains dancing ring around a rosy in the dooryard by moonlight.
I didn't quite laugh, but could envision it all too easily. There was enough to drink, too. There was a fresh tub of beer just brewed in the pantry, and Bobby had fetched down the emergency keg of whiskey from its hiding place in the barn. I lifted Jamie's hand and kissed the cold knuckles. The shock and sense of dislocation had begun to fade with the growing awareness of the pulse of life behind us. The cabin was a small, vibrant island of life, afloat in the cold of the black and white night.
No man is an island entire of itself, Jamie said softly, picking up my unspoken thought.
Now, that one is appropriate, I said, a little dryly. Maybe too appropriate.
Aye, how so?
Never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. I never hear no man is an island without that last line tolling right behind it.
Mm-hmm. Ken the whole of it, do you?
Not waiting for my reply, he leaned forward and stirred the coals with a stick, sending up a tiny drift of silent sparks.
It isn't really a poem, Ken. Or the man didn't mean it to be one.
No, I said, surprised. What is it? Or was it?
A meditation. Something atwixt a sermon and a prayer. John Donne wrote it as part of his devotions upon emergent occasions. That's sufficiently appropriate, no? He added, with a hint of wry humour.
They don't get much more emergent than this, no. What am I missing, then? He pulled me closer and bent his head to rest on mine.
Let me call what I can to mind. I'll not have all of it, but there are bits that struck me, so I remember those.
I could hear his breathing, slow and easy, concentrating.
All mankind is of one author, he said slowly, and is one volume. When one man dies,
One chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language. And every chapter must be so translated.
Then there are bits I haven't got by heart. But I like this one.
The bell doth toll for him that thinks it doth. And his hand squeezed mine gently. And though it intermit again, yet from that minute that that occasion wrought upon him, he is united to God.
I thought about that for a bit. You're right, that's less poetic, but a bit more hopeful. I felt him smile.
I've always found it so, aye.
Where did you get that?
John Gray lent me a wee book of Donne's writing when I was prisoner at Hellwater. That was in it.
A very literate gentleman, I said, somewhat piqued at this reminder of the substantial chunk of Jamie's life that John Gray had shared and I had not, but grudgingly glad that he had had a friend through that time of trial. How often, I wondered suddenly, had Jamie heard that tolling bell?
I sat up, reached for the flask, and took a cleansing swallow. The smell of baking, of onion and simmered meat, was seeping through the door, and my stomach rumbled in an unseemly manner.
Jamie didn't notice. He was squinting thoughtfully off toward the west, where the bulk of the mountain lay hidden by cloud.
The MacLeod lads said the passes were already hip-deep in snow when they came down, he said. If there's a foot of new snow on the ground here, there are three in the high passes. We're going nowhere till the spring thaw, Sassenach. Time enough to carve proper grave markers, at least, he added, with a glance at our quiet guests.
You do still mean to go to Scotland, then?
He'd said so after the big house burned, but hadn't mentioned it since then. I wasn't sure whether he'd meant it, or had merely been reacting to the pressure of events at the time.
I do. We canna be staying here, I think, he said with some regret. Come the spring, the back country will be boiling again. We've come close enough to the fire.
He lifted his chin in the direction of the big house's charred remains.
I've no mind to be roasted next time.
Well, yes. He was right, I knew. We could build another house, but it was unlikely we would be allowed to live peaceably in it. Among other things, Jamie was, or at least had been, a colonel of militia. Short of physical incapacity or simple absence, he couldn't relinquish that responsibility. And sentiment in the mountains was by no means all in favour of rebellion. I knew a number of people who had been beaten, burned out, and driven into the woods or swamps, or killed outright as the direct result of injudiciously expressed political sentiments. The weather prevented our leaving, but it also put a stopper on the movement of militias or roving bands of brigands. The thought of that sent a sudden bolt of cold through me, and I shivered.
"Shall you go in, Ninian?" Jamie asked, noticing. "I can bear watch alone for a bit."
"Right, and we'll come out with the bannocks and honey and find you stretched out beside the old ladies with an axe in your head." "I'm fine."
I took another sip of whiskey and handed him the flask.
"We wouldn't necessarily have to go to Scotland, though," I said, watching him drink. "We could go to New Bern. You could join Fergus in the printing business there." That's what he'd said he meant to do. Go to Scotland, fetch the printing press he had left in Edinburgh, then come back to join the fight, armed with lead in the form of type slugs rather than musket balls. I wasn't sure which method might be the more dangerous.
"You didn't suppose your presence would stop Arch trying to brain me, if that's what he's got in mind?"
Jamie smiled briefly at that, slanted eyes creasing into triangles.
"No. Fergus has a right to put himself in danger, and he wants to. But I've no right to drag him and his family into my own."
"Which tells me all I need to know about what sort of printing you have in mind to do. And my presence might not stop Arch going for you, but I could at least shout, 'Look out,' if I saw him creeping up behind you."
I should always want you at my back, Sassenach, he assured me gravely. You kent already what I mean to do, surely.
Yes, I said with a sigh. Occasionally I have the vain hope that I'm wrong about you, but I never am. That made him laugh outright.
No, you're not, he agreed. But you're still here, aye?
He lifted the flask in salute to me and drank from it.
Good to know someone will miss me when I fall.
I did not miss that when rather than if, I said coldly.
It's always been when, Sassenach, he said gently. Every chapter must be so translated, aye?
I took a deep breath and watched it drift out in a plume of mist. I sincerely hope I'm not going to have to do it, I said. But should the question arise, would you want to be buried here or taken back to Scotland? I was thinking of a granite marriage stone in the graveyard at St. Kilda with his name on it, and mine too. The bloody thing had nearly given me heart failure when I saw it, and I wasn't sure I had forgiven Frank for it, even though it had accomplished what he'd meant it to. Jamie made a small snorting noise, not quite a laugh.
I shall be lucky to be buried at all, Sassenach. Much more likely I shall be drowned, burnt, or left to rot on some battlefield. Then afash yourself. If you've got to dispose of my carcass, just leave it out for the crows.
I'll make a note of that, I said.
Will you mind going to Scotland? He asked, eyebrows raised.
I sighed. Despite my knowing that he wasn't going to lie under that particular gravestone, I couldn't quite rid myself of the notion that he would, at some point, die there. No. I'll mind leaving the mountains. I'll mind watching you turn green and puke your guts out on this ship. And I may well mind whatever happens on the way to said ship. But, Edinburgh and printing presses aside, you want to go to Lallybroch, don't you? He nodded, eyes on the glowing coals. The light from the firepot was faint but warm on the ruddy arch of his brows, a line of gilding down the long, straight bridge of his nose.
I promised, aye, he said simply. I said I'd bring young Ian back to his mother. And after this, best he goes.
I nodded silently. 3,000 miles of ocean might not be enough for Ian to escape his memories, but it couldn't hurt. And perhaps the joy of seeing his parents, his brothers and sisters, the Highlands, perhaps it would help heal him. Jamie coughed and rubbed a knuckle over his lips.
There's the one other thing, he said, a little shy. Another promise, you might see.
What's that? He turned his head then and met my eyes. His own, dark and serious.
I've sworn to myself, he said, that I shall not ever face my son across the barrel of a gun.
I took a deep breath and nodded. After a moment's silence, I looked up from my contemplation of the shrouded women. You didn't ask what I want done with my body. I'd meant it, at least half in jest, to lighten his mood, but his fingers curled so abruptly over mine that I gasped.
No, he said softly, and I never will.
He wasn't looking at me, but at the whiteness before us.
I canna think of you dead, Claire. Anything else, but not that. I can't.
He stood abruptly. The rattle of wood, the clang of a falling pewter dish, and voices raised in adjuration inside saved me from reply. I simply nodded and let him lift me to my feet as the door opened, spilling light. The morning dawned clear and bright, with a scant foot of fresh snow on the ground. By noon, the icicles that hung from the cabin's eaves had begun to loose their hold, dropping like random daggers with muffled, intermittent thunks. Jamie and Ian had gone up the hill to the small burying ground with spades to see whether the ground might be dug deep enough for two decent graves. "Take Aidan and one or two of the other boys with you," I said at breakfast. "They need to be gotten out from underfoot." Jamie had given me a sharp glance, but nodded. He knew very well what I was thinking. If Archbug didn't yet know that his wife was dead, he'd certainly start drawing conclusions if he saw a grave being dug.
"Best if he'll come and speak to me," Jamie had said quietly to me under cover of the noise made by the boys readying themselves to go, their mothers packing lunch to be taken up the hill, and the smaller children playing Ring Around a Rosie in the back room.
"Yes," I said, "and the boys won't stop him doing that. But if he doesn't choose to come out and speak to you..." Ian had told me that he'd heard a rifle fired during the encounter the night before. Archbug was no particular marksman, though, and would presumably hesitate to fire on a group that included young children. Jamie had nodded, silent, and had sent Aidan to fetch his two eldest cousins. Bobby and Clarence the Mule had gone up with a grave-digging party. There was a stock of freshly sawn pine boards at the site higher up on the mountainside, where Jamie had declared our new house would one day rise. If graves could be dug, Bobby would bring back some of the boards to make coffins. From my viewpoint on the front porch, I could see Clarence now, heavily laden, but mincing downhill with ballerina grace, ears pointed delicately to either side as though to aid his balance. I caught a glimpse of Bobby walking on the far side of the mule, reaching up now and then to keep the load from slipping. He saw me and waved, smiling. The M, branded on his cheek, was visible even at this distance, livid against the cold, chapped ruddiness of his skin. I waved back and turned into the house to tell the women that we would indeed have a funeral. We made our way up the winding trail to the small graveyard next morning. The two old ladies, unlikely companions in death, lay side by side in their coffins on a sledge, pulled by Clarence, and one of the McCallum women's mules, a little black Jenny called Puddin. We were not dressed in our best, and no one had a best, with the exception of Amy McCallum Higgins, who had worn her lace-trimmed wedding kerchief as a sign of respect. We were mostly clean, though, and the adults, at least, were sober in aspect and watchful. Very watchful.
"Which will be the new guardian, ma'am?"
Aidan asked his mother, eyeing the two coffins as the sledge creaked slowly uphill ahead of us.
"Which died first?"
"Why, I dunna ken, Aidan," Amy replied, looking mildly taken aback. She frowned at the coffins, then glanced at me.
"Do you know that, Mrs. Fraser?"
The question hit me like a thrown pebble, and I blinked. I did know, of course, but with some effort I refrained from glancing into the trees that lined the trail. I had no idea exactly where Archbug was, but he was near, I had no doubt of that at all. And if he were near enough to overhear this conversation... Highland superstition held that the last person to be buried in a graveyard became the guardian, and must defend the souls who rested there from any evil until another should die and take the guardian's place, whereupon the earlier guardian was released and might go on to heaven. I didn't think Arch would be at all happy about the notion of his wife trapped on earth to guard the graves of Presbyterians and sinners like Mulver Christie. I felt a small chill in the heart at the thought of Mulva, who was, now I thought of it, presumably the graveyard's present guardian. Presumably, because while other people had died on the ridge since her own death, she was the last to have been buried in the graveyard proper. Her brother, Alan, was buried nearby, a little way into the forest, in a secret unmarked grave. I didn't know whether that was near enough to count. And her father... I coughed into my fist and, clearing my throat, said, "Oh, Mrs. McLeod. She was dead when we came back to the cabin with Mrs. Bug." Which was strictly true. The fact that she had been dead when I left the cabin seemed better suppressed. I had been looking at Amy when I spoke. I turned my head back to the trail, and there he was, right in front of me. Archbug, in his rusty black cloak, white head bared and bent, following the sledge through the snow, slow as an earthbound raven. A faint shudder ran through the mourners. He turned his head then, and saw me.
"Will you sing, Mrs. Fraser?"
he asked, his voice quiet and courtly.
"I'll have her taken to her rest with the proper observances."
Yes, of course." Enormously flustered, I groped for something suitable. I simply wasn't up to the challenge of composing a proper charis, a lament for the dead, let alone providing the formal wailing that a truly first-class Highland funeral would have. I settled hastily for a Gaelic psalm that Roger had taught me, Issa dea fin as buachal go. It was a line chant, each line meant to be sung by a precentor, then echoed line by line by the congregation. It was simple, though, and while my voice seemed thin and insubstantial on the mountainside, those around me were able to take it up, and by the time we reached the burying ground, we had achieved a respectable level of fervour and volume. The sledge stopped at the edge of the pine-circled clearing. A few wooden crosses and cairns were visible through the half-melted snow, and the two fresh graves gaped in the centre, muddy and brutal. The sight of them stopped the singing as abruptly as a pail of cold water. The sun shone pale and bright through the trees, and there was a gang of nuthatches conversing in the branches at the edge of the clearing, incongruously cheerful. Jamie had been leading the mules and had not glanced back at Arch's appearance. Now, though, he turned to Arch, and with a small gesture at the nearer coffin, asked in a low voice,
"Will you look upon your wife once more?"
It was only as Arch nodded and moved to the side of the sledge that I realized that while the men had nailed down the lid of Mrs. MacLeod's coffin, they had left Mrs. Bugg's lying loose. Bobby and Ian lifted it off, their eyes on the ground. Arch had unbound his hair as a sign of grief. I had never seen it loose before. It was thin, pure white, and wavered about his face like wisps of smoke as he bent and gently lifted the shroud from Merdina's face. I swallowed hard, clenching my hands. I'd removed the arrow, not a pleasant business, and had then wrapped her throat carefully in a clean bandage before combing her hair. She looked all right, though terribly unfamiliar. I didn't think I'd ever seen her without her cap, and the bandage across her full throat gave her the sternly formal air of a Presbyterian minister. I saw Arch flinch, just slightly, and his own throat move. He got control of his face almost at once, but I saw the lines that ran from nose to chin like gullies through wet clay, and the way in which he opened and closed his hands over and over, seeking a grip on something that wasn't there. He gazed into the coffin for a long moment, then reached into his sporran and drew out something. I saw, when he put back his cloak, that his belt was empty. He had come without weapons. The thing in his hand was small and glittering. He leaned down and tried to fix it to the shroud, but couldn't with his missing fingers. He fumbled, said something under his breath in Gaelic, then looked up at me with something near panic in his eyes. I went at once to him and took the thing from his hand. It was a brooch, a small, beautifully made thing in the shape of a flying swallow, made of gold and very new-looking. I took it from him and, turning back the shroud, pinned it to Mrs. Bug's kerchief. I'd never seen the brooch before, either on Mrs. Bug or among her things, and it came to me that Arch had likely had it made from the gold he had taken from Jocasta Cameron, perhaps when he began to take the ingots one by one, perhaps later. A promise made to his wife that their years of penury and dependence were over. Well, indeed they were. I glanced at Arch, and at his nod, pulled the shroud gently up over his wife's cold face. I put out a hand impulsively to touch him, take his arm. But he drew away and stood back, watching impassively as Bobby nailed down the lid. At one point, his gaze rose and passed slowly over Jamie, then Ian, in turn. I pressed my lips tight, glancing at Jamie as I came back to his side, seeing the trouble etched so plainly on his face. So much guilt. Not that there wasn't enough, and to spare. And, plainly enough, Arch felt his own.
Did it not occur to any of them that Mrs. Bugg had had something to do with this herself? Had she not fired at Jamie? But people didn't always behave intelligently, or well. And did the fact that someone had contributed to their own demise lessen the tragedy of it?
I caught sight of the small boulder that marked the grave of Mulver and her son, only the top of it visible through the snow, rounded, wet, and dark like the crowning of a baby's head at birth.
Rest in peace, I thought, and felt a small easing of the tension I'd been under for the last 2 days. You can go now.
It occurred to me that whatever I'd told Amy and Aidan, it didn't alter the truth of which woman really had died first. Still, considering Mrs. Bugg's personality, I rather thought she might enjoy being in charge, clucking and fussing after the resident souls like her flock of much-loved chickens, banishing evil spirits with a sharp word and a brandished sausage. That thought got me through the brief reading from the Bible, the prayers, the tears, from the women and the children, most of whom had no idea why they were crying, the removal of the coffins from the sledge, and a rather disjointed recitation of the Lord's Prayer. I missed Roger very much, his sense of calm order and genuine compassion in the conducting of a funeral. And he would perhaps have known what to say in eulogy of Medina Bugg. As it was, no one spoke when the prayer concluded, and there was a long, awkward pause, people shifting uneasily from foot to foot. We were standing in a foot of snow, and the women's petticoats were wet to the knee. I saw Jamie shift his shoulders as though his coat was too tight, and glance at the sledge where the shovels lay under a blanket. Before he could signal Ian and Bobby, though, Ian drew a deep, gasping breath and stepped forward. He came to the side of Mrs. Bugg's waiting coffin opposite the bereaved husband and stopped, plainly wanting to speak. Arch ignored him for a long moment, staring down into the hole, but finally raised his face, impassive. Waiting.
"It was by my hand that this," Ian swallowed, "that this woman of great worth has died. I did not take her life by malice or of purpose, and it is sorrow to me. But she died by my hand."
Rollo whined softly by Ian's side, feeling his master's distress. But Ian laid a hand on his head, and he stilled. Ian drew the knife from his belt and laid it on the coffin in front of Arch Bugg, then straightened and looked him in the eye.
"You swore once to my uncle, in a time of great wrong, and offered life for this woman. I swear by my iron, and I offer the same."
His lips pressed together for an instant, and his throat moved, his eyes dark and sober.
"I think you maybe didna mean it, sir, but I do."
I found that I was holding my breath and forced myself to breathe. Was this Jamie's plan? I wondered. Ian plainly meant what he said. Still, the chances of Arch accepting that offer on the spot and cutting Ian's throat in front of a dozen witnesses were slim, no matter how exigent his feelings. But if he publicly declined the offer, then the possibility of a more formal and less bloody recompense was opened. Yet young Ian would be relieved of at least a measure of his guilt. "Bloody Highlander," I thought, glancing up at Jamie, not without a certain admiration. I could feel small jolts of energy running through him, though, every few seconds, each one suppressed. He wouldn't interfere with Ian's attempt at atonement, but neither would he see him injured if, by chance, old Arch did opt for blood. And evidently he thought it a possibility. I glanced at Arch and thought so too. The old man looked at Ian for a moment, heavy brows wild with curling iron-grey old man hairs, and the eyes beneath them iron-grey too, and cold as steel.
"Too easy, boy,"
he said at last, in a voice like rusty iron.
He looked down at Rollo, who was standing next to Ian, ears pricked and wolf eyes wary.
"Will you give me your hound to kill?"
Ian's mask broke in an instant, shock and horror making him suddenly young. I heard him gulp air and steady himself, but his voice was cracked in reply.
"No," he said. "He's done nothing. It's my crime, not his."
Arch smiled then, very slightly, though it did not touch his eyes.
"Aye, you see then.
And he's no but a flea-ridden beast,
not a wife."
"Wife" was spoken in barely a whisper. His throat worked as he cleared it. Then he looked carefully from Ian to Jamie, and then at me.
"Not a wife,"
he said softly. I'd thought my blood ran cold already. That froze my heart. In no hurry, Arch turned his gaze deliberately upon each man in turn. Jamie, then Ian, whom he regarded for an instant that seemed a lifetime.
"When you've something worth taking, boy, you'll see me again,"
he said quietly, then turned upon his heel and walked into the trees. Chapter 5. Morality for Time Travellers. There was an electric desk lamp in his study, but Roger often preferred to work by candlelight in the evening. He took a match from the box and struck it with one soft scratch. After Claire's letter, he didn't think he'd ever light a match again without thinking of her story of the burning of the big house. God, he wished he'd been there. The match flame shrank as he touched it to the wick, and the translucent wax of the candle went a dim, unearthly blue for an instant, then brightened into its normal glow. He glanced at Mandy, singing to a collection of stuffed toys on the sofa. She'd had her bath, and was meant to be keeping out of trouble while Jem had his. Keeping one eye on her, he sat down at his desk and opened his notebook. He'd begun it half as a joke, the other half as the only thing he could think of to combat paralyzing fear. "You can teach kids not to cross the street alone," Bree had pointed out. "Surely you can teach them to stay the heck away from standing stones." He'd agreed, but with substantial mental reservations. Small kids, yes, you could brainwash them into not sticking forks in the electric outlets. But as they became teenagers, with all that inchoate yearning for self-discovery and things unknown. He recalled his own teenage self much too vividly. Tell a teenaged boy not to stick forks in the outlet, and he'd be off rifling the silverware drawer the minute your back was turned. Girls might be different, but he doubted it. He glanced again at the sofa, where Amanda was now lying on her back, legs thrust into the air, and a large, ratty-looking stuffed bear balanced on her feet, to which she was singing Frère Jacques. Mandy had been so young that she wouldn't remember. Jem would. He did. Roger could tell. When the little boy woke up from nightmares, eyes huge and staring at nothing, and could not describe his dream. Thank God it didn't happen often. He still broke out in a cold sweat whenever he remembered it himself. That last passage. He'd clutched Jemmy to his chest and stepped into... God, there was no name for it, because humanity at large had never experienced it. And lucky for them, they hadn't. It wasn't even like anything to which it could be compared. None of the senses worked there. And at the same time, all of them did. in such a state of hypersensitivity that you'd die of it if it lasted any longer than it did. A howling void where sound seemed to batter you, pulsing through your body, trying to separate each cell from the next. Absolute blindness. But the blindness of looking into the sun. And the impact of bodies? Ghosts? Unseen others who brushed past like moth wings or seemed to hurtle right through you in a colliding thump of entangling bones. A constant sense of screaming. Did it smell? He paused, frowning, trying to remember. Yes, it damned well did. And oddly enough, it was a describable smell, the scent of air burned by lightning. Ozone. It smells strongly of ozone, he wrote, feeling remarkably relieved to have even this small foothold of reference to the normal world. This relief disappeared in the next instant as he returned to the